From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. What a week.
Fox News alert, a Tea Party group is now demanding that Congress pull funding from NPR after a soon-to-be ex-fundraising executive is caught on tape slamming conservatives and the Tea Party.
We know this is video from February 22nd, apparently shot by two people posing as members of a fictitious Muslim organization that was trying to give NPR, National Public Radio, executives $5 million. One of those NPR execs, Ron Schiller, was telling the
He was caught on tape trying to ingratiate himself to the donors by disparaging Jews, the Tea Party, and Republicans. It was a sting set up by the controversial conservative filmmaker James O'Keefe, better known for videos targeting the community organizers at Acorn.
The timing could not be worse. The House just voted to stop all funding of public broadcasting, $430 million this year.
All right, the other shoe has now dropped at NPR moments ago. NPR announcing that its president and CEO Vivian Schiller has resigned.
It was a rough week and a tough season for NPR, starting 5 months ago with the mishandled firing of NPR News analyst Juan Williams and ending with the sting of NPR fundraiser Ron Schiller for saying the darndest things.
The current Republican Party, the particular Tea Party, is fanatically involved in people's personal lives and very fundamental Christian, and I wouldn't even call it Christian, it's this weird evangelical...
Now a great yawning vacuum has opened at NPR. No chief news executive with the earlier departure of Ellen Weiss. No top fundraiser, as Ron Schiller was already slated to leave. And now, no president.
The real role for me here is steady hand on the tiller.
Joyce Slocum, NPR's general counsel and senior vice president of legal affairs, was named interim president and CEO. She says that the political fallout from the sting will not change NPR's journalism.
And knowing our newsroom and our journalists as I do, I think that they are going to continue to take great care to ensure that their coverage is balanced, that they are bringing a variety of voices to any given issue.
As a practical political matter, if you hired Roger Ailes himself and brought Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck in to host All Things Considered, do you think you have the capacity to change anybody's perceptions?
Well, there are hardened critics who are never going to change their perception. But the really amazing thing that happens with a lot of people who have misperceptions about NPR but are not hardened in those misperceptions is all it takes for them to change that perception is to turn on their local member station and listen for a couple of hours.
Vivian Schiller's considerable accomplishments and mistakes expose the tripwires that inevitably hobble any intrepid NPR exec. Schiller pulled NPR into the digital age, expanding its web presence, developing mobile apps, and exploiting social media. She took a network reeling from waves of cutbacks and put it on a secure financial footing. But she had never been a CEO, much less of a nonprofit membership organization trapped in political crosshairs. She reacted clumsily to the precipitous firing of Juan Williams for a comment he made on Fox News, and she thanked the Obama administration for its budgetary support, which some claim framed public broadcasting as a Democratic cause.
As if it had ever been framed as anything else. As we look back on the history of public broadcasting, what's happening now seems inevitable. It's happened over and over again. And in that context, the sting operation is just a sideshow to the main event, which is an argument over money framed by some Republicans in Washington like this. Why should public broadcasting be defunded? Because, A, public broadcasting has a pervasive left-wing bias, B, the nation is in a financial crisis and has more pressing priorities, C, the government has no business funding media, and D, all of the above.
It should not be the taxpayers' responsibility to fund news organizations with a partisan point of view.
I think it's right that the CEO stepped down. It would be more right, though, if we seize this time of a fiscal crisis to say it's time to end public funding for NPR.
Where isn't the Constitution says the federal government's supposed to be funding competition for private networks with a public television or public radio in any way?
Those were Republican members of Congress Eric Cantor, Mike Pence, and Senator Tom Coburn. For the record, we called 14 House and Senate Republicans for comment. They either did not respond or turned us down flat, including House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Senators Jim DeMint and Tom Coburn, co-sponsors of the bill to defund public broadcasting. Newt Gingrich has forthrightly argued to end federal funding. He also turned us down. But that's okay. Some things don't change.
One of the things we're going to do this year, I hope, is to zero out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That was Gingrich in 1994. In 1995, South Dakota Senator Larry Pressler sent a 16-page questionnaire to public broadcasters seeking information about the ethnic backgrounds, sexes, and previous employment of NPR staffers. He told us this week that eliminating federal support would make NPR more professional.
For example, when I was in the Senate, NPR said that I had asked about the religions of people there. We never ask about the religions, and the New York Times wrote a retraction and a major article saying that. But it was so hard to get NPR to broadcast that. Recently, the error made on the death of Gabby Giffords, which we don't know, it might have just been a crank call that came in. But Ms. Schiller said our processes made mistakes. And many people feel that the error in that story was just the tip of the iceberg. Because frequently in the last few years, NPR has just been wrong on many stories and just quietly corrects them later without any explanation.
Senator, could I just interrupt for a moment to ask you if you truly believe that this news organization, which has shelves and shelves and shelves full of Peabody Awards and silver batons and all of the highest honors in broadcast, whether you seriously believe that there is anything on the air, on radio or television today, that even comes close to competing with it. I mean, are you really citing one or two fact errors as evidence that it is an unprofessional organization?
Now, if it does have all those Peabody Awards, which it does, that's an argument that it can raise the money very easily. People will appreciate that, including myself. I will contribute. But it shouldn't be getting federal funds.
So either NPR is bad because of public funding, or it's so good it doesn't need public funding.
Our nation wants more than just material wealth.
President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act in 1967. Back then, 90% of the money went to public television.
Our nation wants more than a chicken in every pot. We in America have an appetite for excellence, too. And while we work every day to produce new goods and to create new wealth, we want most of all to enrich man's spirit, and that is the purpose of this act.
I was the first employee of NPR, and I had a title, something like called associate.
Jack Mitchell was present at the creation. He says that in the mid-60s, all the energy and talent in public broadcasting had migrated to television. Public radio consisted of about 100 low-power stations. In fact, Johnson's proposed act was initially called
the Public Television Act to create a public television corporation. These fellows in radio basically launched a guerrilla action to get the words "and radio" stuck in every time the word television appeared in the Public Television Act. And it was a long battle and a very quiet battle because most people didn't know this was going on.
Because the public radio system was so weak, NPR was created in February of 1970. It got all of the public radio money and created a program.
The first regular scheduled program was, all things considered, 5 days a week, 90 minutes at 5 o'clock Eastern Time.
There wasn't a foreign desk. There wasn't a national desk.
Oh, there were four reporters, and they weren't all that experienced. In the early days of public radio, we were quite blatantly anti-Nixon, anti-war, pro-civil rights. This was the 1970s. And it came across in our broadcasting far more than it did in public television. But Nixon and his crew at the White House didn't know he existed. And so we just blithely went along, and the White House went after public television for doing things that are far less blatant than what we were doing.
Public broadcasting has at some point or another annoyed every administration since its inception. But despite the bipartisan irritation its journalism engenders, Republican legislators invariably lead the charge to kill the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funnels federal support. But so far, they've failed because a majority of voters, including Republican voters, value public broadcasting. Still, the fight continues decade after decade.
Yeah, frankly, it is very clear that we would be better off in the long run without federal funding.
So saith disgraced ex-NPR fundraiser Ron Schiller. NPR receives only about 2% of its income directly from the CPB. Federal funding mostly goes to stations that pay dues to NPR for programs. It provides roughly 10% of the public radio economy. But for small stations, that percentage can be a lot higher. In rural communities, it can run as high as 30, sometimes as high as 50%.
I would decouple public television and public radio and leave NPR on its own.
Frank Mankiewicz was NPR's president from 1977 to 1983 after serving as campaign director for George McGovern in 72 and press secretary to Senator Robert Kennedy. A liberal, to be sure, but one who tried to make NPR less reliant on federal funding by launching projects that caused a huge budget gap, spawning a financial crisis in 1983. That's when public funding was rerouted to the stations, and that's when Jack Mitchell, NPR's first employee, briefly returned.
At that point, I really realized how different it was. It had become a very powerful, important, professional journalistic organization. And I realized that the whole mentality of the place had shifted from those kind of values that we had at the very beginning, which was alternative, alternative, what can we do that's different, to how can we do what everybody else does but does it better. So it was about 1983 that really hit me, but it's just continued on and on and on since.
Is firing the CEO for the foolish remarks of a fundraiser the act of a mature, confident news organization? Not according to Frank Mankiewicz.
I don't think that this event should have been responsible for her firing. I think she was a very competent executive and was taking NPR in the right direction.
John Stewart called NPR's board a bunch of pussies.
A bunch of what?
Pussies.
Cookies?
Pussies.
Oh, pussies. Yeah, that may be true.
Up next, a fair and balanced discussion of federal funding.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Following the Juan Williams debacle in October of last year, Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina wrote an op-ed in the Washington Examiner titled, "Let NPR Fend for Itself on the Market." Well, let's discuss. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, created in 1967, has an annual budget of about $400 million. As we noted, that money is dispersed to public radio and TV affiliates around the country and indirectly to NPR. To be clear, government funding makes up only a small percentage of most stations' budgets. For example, here at WNYC, we're told it's about 6%. Nevertheless, in a time of economic extremis, should the government reconsider its funding for public broadcasting? Last fall, Reason.com editor-in-chief Nick Gillespie told us, yes, public media was created to serve, quote, the public interest. And so what exactly does that mean?
The idea of a public interest is philosophically, politically, linguistically incoherent.
Linguistically?
My enthusiasm ran away with me there for a second. But I support defunding not because I dislike art, not because I dislike culture or dislike radio or many things on PBS, but precisely because I like them. And I think that it's time to take away the small sliver of funding that allows a lot of political interference and annoyance.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is unusual in that it has forward funding. It's a few years in advance to minimize direct political interference in its content.
The small amount of funding, what is it? It's under $100 million a year that NPR gets from various sources from the federal government. That allows people like John Boehner, and it allows Democrats at various points to kind of hue and cry, and you pull that plank out from under them. I don't think that the quality and the mission of NPR would suffer, and you would shut up loudmouths who are always looking to grab a microphone or get in front of a TV camera. Why should the personnel choices of NPR be of any interest to the Congress of the United States? The short answer is it shouldn't be.
If you listen to, say, morning radio, one of the most popular shows on it is Morning Edition. Substantive, informative. Would such a program exist if it were as obsessed with the bottom line as so much of the rest of radio is?
I am extremely confident that NPR's nonprofit ethos would survive any cut in federal spending. And in fact, it might even grow stronger. The federal government is broke, and it's only going to get more and more broke. And at this point, we need to say, what are the core functions of government? And I think most people would agree that defense is one of them. Courts, maybe citizenship, things like that. The idea that we have an inalienable right to Car Talk or to Sesame Street being piped in over the air on tax-supported airwaves, that strikes me as a stretch. And it's time to rethink that, not because those are bad programs, but because they're not core functions of government, and they will be funded via other avenues. I think that the analogous model here is religion and religious expression. We all want to live in a world where everybody can worship whatever God they want, but nobody is forced to pay for other people's belief systems. Whether we're talking about Presbyterians and Baptists or Fox News enthusiasts and PBS tote bag holders.
I guess fundamentally, this all boils down to what you think of public broadcasting. If you think it's a left-wing, inflected source of information, then there would be no reason to support it. But if you think, you know, going back to that old chestnut, that it actually leads to a more informed electorate that can make a better democracy, then you might have a different view.
In my case, this is completely viewpoint neutral. It doesn't matter to me what is being said. It matters how it's being funded. I mean, every historian of both LBJ and Richard Nixon will tell you that they applied pressure directly and indirectly to over-the-air broadcasts.
That is true, but most of that pressure has, in fact, been lifted. I mean, the fairness doctrine has been a thing of the past since Reagan.
Why not finish the job then and, you know, shut John Boehner up, shut Eric Cantor up, shut Michelle Bachmann up, from being able to say, you know what, I'm paying for this microphone, so it better reflect what I think and what I feel. You know, one of the things that the architects of public broadcasting in the late 60s could not foresee was the vast multiplication of sites of production and consumption of media, but also the models.
Although there certainly is a lot more verbiage, just having a lot of people yelling at you 24 hours a day does not mean that we are swimming in a salubrious sea of useful information.
Just as there are more people screaming and shouting and also uncovering really interesting stories, something like WikiLeaks, there are also agencies and groups and filters that check and double check and triple check. We have never lived in a richer, better time for journalism and for information and for public discourse than we do right now.
I totally buy that.
And for that reason, screw the public interest if you are going to define it in some kind of 1965 best and the brightest mentality. That's an old and dangerous version of the public interest. The public interest is every time people are going online or turning on the TV or the radio and getting information and processing it. And we're going gangbusters. We don't need a tax on that.
Nick, thank you very much.
My pleasure. And the minute that the federal government actually defunds NPR, my checkbook will be open to at least make up my differential.
You are too kind. Nick Gillespie is editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason.tv.
Around the same time that Senator DeMint wrote his op-ed calling to defund NPR, New America Foundation President Steve Kahl wrote an open letter to the Federal Communications Commission. In it, he argued that we should rethink much of our media policy here in the United States, starting with an increase in funding for public media, which, Kahl says, was created to raise the level of public discourse.
The purpose was to add to the mix the kind of programming and mission that commercial broadcasters will not find profitable, but which is nonetheless in the public interest. We build school systems to educate Americans, even though they're not profitable. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't have a commercially dominated media. I am arguing that the commercially dominated media does not produce public interest journalism adequately.
The fact is, Steve, that public broadcasting has become kind of a political piñata. It is deemed to represent a liberal worldview that some on the right just don't want to subsidize in any way, shape, or form. Is there a way around that philosophical objection to the tone or the values of public broadcast?
First, we shouldn't overinterpret the criticism, but we should listen to it. At the same time, in order to carry out its role, like the Federal Reserve or the Securities and Exchange Commission or your local prosecutor, it requires a certain degree of professional independence. And so the best thing to do is to strengthen the independence of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting while holding it accountable across the political spectrum.
So Nick Gillespie's solution is to defund public broadcasting and end the argument about whether public broadcast is too politically inflected. You have a slightly different approach. You say, as a society, we should double down. We should increase the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. What's the scheme?
The idea that originates in the law that commercial broadcasters using public spectrum have an obligation to serve the public in exchange for that privilege, that idea has evolved into a farcical system in which the commercial broadcasters essentially fill out forms that they keep in their own offices saying, well, we did some crime reporting yesterday, so we've educated the public about spousal abuse or child abuse. It doesn't serve the public, but it wastes a lot of money. So the essence of it is that you relieve the commercial broadcasters of their expensive and ineffective public interest obligation and instead extract spectrum usage fees that can be directed to strengthen public media. And in addition, the FCC is overseeing multi-billion dollar new spectrum auctions, and it would be quite simple to tack into those auctions user fees that could be directed to public broadcasting. And I promise you, as a percentage of the profits that they will make from those spectrum auctions, the fees we're talking about are a fraction of what they pay their investment bankers just to get to the table.
That said, your open letter to the FCC predated by about 3 days a gigantic sweep in the midterm elections of Republicans into Congress. I'm going to take a wild stab here and say you haven't gotten a call from John Boehner's office saying, why, Steve, tell me more about your plan.
It's early. He's making a lot of calls this week. I do think that it is in the interests of all political actors in the United States to have a healthy public broadcasting system. Look, what is it like to be a professional politician in this environment? The internet can come alive with false rumors about your conduct. If you go on television to try to make yourself heard, you've got 20 seconds and it may be a shouting match with somebody on the other side, but it is in their mutual interest to construct, as Britain has, a public broadcasting system where civil, deep, serious, inclusive debate about the issues of the day can take place. I mean, if you've lived in Britain and you turn on their morning public broadcasting shows, you could not paint them politically. But what you do find is that everybody who's a political actor has time to make their arguments.
You're talking about a continent that has primetime programming devoted to literary criticism. These people are not like you and me. Steve, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Steve Kahl is a frequent contributor to New Yorker, and he is president of the New America Foundation.
Hey, guys.
Ira Glass, host of This American Life.
As I live and breathe.
So, Ira, what are you doing here?
Well, are you guys going to cover, like, the thing that nobody talks about in this whole debate over defunding public radio, or at least nobody in public radio talks about it, which is
The elephant in the room?
Yes. All the conversations about defunding public radio, if you look at the lobbying effort that public radio and public TV have mounted, they had this campaign called 170 million, and there's a website, and it's all about how 170 million Americans each month listen to public radio or watch public TV, and we're all in this together, and that includes a lot of conservatives. And I feel like it completely sidesteps the actual substance of the main attack on public radio, and that is the attack that we have a left-wing liberal bias. Can I play you guys a clip?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. This is Bill O'Reilly from Fox News, which is the source of most of this.
NPR has now devolved into a totalitarian outfit functioning as an arm of the far left. There's no question about that.
That's funny. That same video clip was played at our conference call this morning with Kim Jong-il when he gave us our marching orders.
Okay, so Ira, what's your beef then, really? Is it that Public radio itself is not willing to take this on? Because about 25 years ago, I was asked to do a piece, is NPR biased to the left? And I couldn't find a metric to apply to the question in order to answer it.
I don't know the methodology somebody would use, but I feel like public radio should address this directly, because I think anybody who listens to our stations understands that what they're hearing is mainstream media reporting. We have nothing to fear from a discussion of what is the news coverage we're doing. As somebody who works in public radio, it is killing me that people on the right are going around trying to basically rebrand us, saying that it's biased news, it's left-wing news, when I feel like anybody who listens to the shows knows that it's not, and we are not fighting back. We're not saying anything back. I find it completely annoying, and I don't understand it.
Okay, so this gets back to not only Brooke's problem finding a metric to report on this story, but it's especially difficult when you and I both know that if you were to somehow poll the political orientation of everybody in the NPR news organization and at all of the member stations, you would find an overwhelmingly progressive, liberal crowd, not uniformly, but overwhelmingly.
Journalism in general, reporters tend to be Democrats and tend to be more liberal than the public as a whole. Sure. But that doesn't change what is going out over the air. And I feel like, well, let's measure the product. And you're saying, what's the metric that we can measure the product on? I would say, go through, you know, this morning's morning edition and find me even a sentence that smells like political bias to you. Like find one. And, you know, the problem with this, can I just keep talking or do you need to
get
questions?
Sure. No, go ahead.
Okay. So I've actually talked to the people who run that lobbying campaign for public radio and asked, like, how come we're not defending our brand? How come we're not arguing on the question of left-wing bias? And they say, well, as a political fight, it's a really hard one because you can get into this kind of he said, she said, where if the other side can find one crazy example, it becomes very hard to argue. So they're like, let's stay away from that when we're lobbying Congress. But at the same time, there's a sense, and I've talked to some people at NPR and at our distributor, PRI, where there's a sense of like, we need to, when this political fight is done, we need to actually go out and reassert, here's who we are with the audience. And in fact, Vivian Schiller, president of NPR, who quit this week, on Monday, she gave a speech at the National Press Club, which was an opening salvo in that, where she basically made a speech saying, like, we are mainstream media. This is not left-wing media. I just think that that is not enough of the messaging. And I don't even exactly know if I'm using the word messaging right here. But
okay, Ira, what do you want us to do?
Well, on the media, you are the perfect vehicle for this. You were made for this purpose, to measure the political bias of public radio. It needs to be done. You are the only ones. You are the ones best positioned of everyone in the country, in the public radio system, in the world, to do this mission, and I hand it to you. It's an urgent mission, and it needs to be done and done beautifully.
What if the answer is yes, NPR has a left-wing bias?
It's not going to be yes.
What if the answer is it doesn't have a left-wing bias? Is that going to change anyone's mind?
Well, there are certain people you're never going to change their mind, and there are certain people who are capitalizing for political gain on the thought that it's a biased network. But the fact is that I think there's a persuadable group of people who are ready to hear that message, if you could come up with the proof.
Yeah, one more thing, though, and this is one of those genie back in the bottle things. No matter what methodology you choose and no matter what the results are, for now and forever, people can point to Ron Schiller in the Sting tape running his mouth and confirming all of the most sinister thoughts anybody in the Republican Party has ever had.
The thing that I would note is that Ron Schiller was not saying it on our air. He's not a reporter, and you would never hear anything like that from any of our reporters. How do you counter that? With the truth, baby, with the truth. That's all we got. Listen to what we're doing on the air and measure it. Call it impractical. Call it idealistic, but I have to believe if we get out there with the truth, that weapon is a real weapon and actually means something.
Ira?
Yes?
That's impractical, unrealistic, and naive.
But you'll do it.
Okay.
Okay.
So, folks, tune in next week to hear how we pick up the gauntlet thrown down by Ira Glass.
Coming up, a victory for privacy advocates is undercut by us. Just can't stop giving our private information away. Also, the life and times of the unprecedented Stuxnet worm, the biggest worm in computer history whose parentage is still unknown. Although, that also could be us.
Stuxnet can spread via USB key, but for each USB key that Stuxnet infects, it can only hop to three machines. Now that's enough to create a moderate chain reaction, but not a full-blown epidemic. That is a level of caution that is much more suggestive of a diplomatically minded power than not.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation, working to advance innovations in education and entrepreneurial success. Learn more at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last spring, we reported on a legal battle between the U.S. government and privacy advocates around the issue of cell phone tracking. Almost all new cell phones contain a built-in GPS location chip so that emergency workers can find you when you call 911. But the ability to locate your position down to a few meters has been used by law enforcement officials as well. As Kevin Bankston, a lawyer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, told us last year.
At a security and surveillance conference a few months ago, the Sprint electronic surveillance manager admitted that law enforcement was making such extensive use of this capability that Sprint had set up essentially a web portal for law enforcement to go to ping cell phones to find their location based on GPS. He said that that website had been used 8 million times over a one-year period.
In September of last year, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the privacy hawks, agreeing that the government should first show probable cause and obtain a warrant before tracking Americans. However, stronger privacy protections only help you when you yourself aren't giving away that information. If you take a picture with your iPhone, that digital file will include the longitude and latitude of where it was snapped. Or if you've opted into the geolocation services of a mobile application like Twitter, your tweets will be accompanied by information about where and when you tweeted. Yanis Kakavas, a programmer in Germany, created a program called Creepy. It aggregates all the data you're sending out and lets anyone build a map showing where you were and what you tweeted, flickered, or foursquared. Kakavas says the software is meant to be cautionary, to warn the typical web user that they've probably been disclosing a lot more than they realize.
Let's say that the user goes back home from work and he thinks that the only thing he said was, "I got back home." But if the coordinates of the place that he tweeted that from are present in the tweet, he just gave out to the whole world, where is he living?
And parents who would never think of leaving details about their children are doing it all the time when they're putting up pictures of them saying, "Look, here's Brittany in the backyard." And all of a sudden, I suppose, putting Brittany at some risk.
It can be even worse, like here's Brittany in the primary school, or here's Brittany at her favorite ice cream shop, or here's Brittany at her favorite playground, giving away information where the parents are hanging out with their children and leaving everyone to know how and when they can reach them.
Now, obviously, the universe of kidnapping targets is rather small, but I guess that's not the point. You've located a security flaw on our personal behavior, right?
Yes.
It seems to me that what you're doing is analogous to locating a security flaw in the public water supply and saying that such and such a reservoir could easily be filled with toxic chemicals that could poison a whole city. So we as a community have learned that our reservoir is vulnerable, but you've also put the idea in the head of potential terrorists who might go out and with a super soaker filled with dioxin and poison an entire city. Did you weigh the risks before publishing this software of actually getting bad people to do exactly what you're warning people about?
I think that the analogy is a bit hazardous, but what the application does, it's nothing that cannot be done manually. So if someone with malicious intent wanted to do something like that, he could do it maybe not as easily as hitting three clicks, but he could do it in 1 hour, getting this information from someone's public Twitter timeline.
So the irony of all of this from our perspective at On the Media is that we spend a whole lot of time looking at how law enforcement and government can track its citizens legally and extra-legally by their smartphones. And yet many of us evidently have made ourselves extraordinarily vulnerable to being tracked not only by the FBI, but by, you know, anybody. Have we been following the wrong problem?
Yeah, maybe, because the, let's say, enemy is not only a terrorist or the state or somebody who might want to track us. It's the enemy in that case is a need for showing off and oversharing our information.
Yanis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yanis Kakavas is creator of Creepy. So being tracked by GPS is creepy. Turns out that trying to evade GPS tracking by disrupting it is downright dangerous. So says New Scientist magazine's David Hambling, who recently wrote that just a few bucks spent on a dashboard-mounted device can jam GPS signals, and that can have potentially catastrophic consequences.
For about $20, you can buy a unit that will jam every GPS system within range. Because the GPS satellites are only broadcasting at a power of about 10 watts, and they're 12,000 miles away, anything that's broadcasting, say, 1 watt or something like that, the kind of output of a mobile phone, that will completely overwhelm the signal from a satellite a long distance away.
Now, if we were only using GPS to find the nearest Starbucks, that would be one set of problems. But we rely on GPS to do many, many things that most people probably aren't even aware of. Can you give me a short list?
It's described as an invisible utility, and that's about right. Because it's a means of providing extremely accurate time signals very cheaply, because you get a $10,000 atomic clock, effectively, for $10. It's used in a lot of services that require very accurate timing. Cell phones need an accurate time signal to synchronize their signals. Power utility companies use it to synchronize the output of alternating current so they can plug into each other. Financial services use it for sending encrypted communications.
Give me some examples of how easily GPS signals have been jammed and the consequences of those incidents.
Well, there was a very unfortunate incident last year at Newark Airport. They've just installed a new landing approach system for use in bad weather, which would allow pilots to land when they couldn't see. And they found that this was shutting itself down twice a day. And the reason turned out to be because it relied on GPS. And there was some guy driving past in a truck twice a day with a GPS jammer. It might have been to avoid road tolls, because there are some toll roads there that use a GPS-based system to calculate where the vehicle is and how many miles it's done on the toll road.
Oh, so he's on the New Jersey Turnpike, and and this is his way to exit the turnpike without having to pony up. If GPS can be so easily, inexpensively defeated for the most mundane of reasons, and if we so depend on it, what's the solution?
The experts I talked to all agreed on the same solution. It's a thing called LORAN, which is an older system than GPS, but it's like a land-based version rather than a satellite-based version. So it only has a range of about 1,000 miles or so, but with a fairly modest system, you can cover the continental US. Because it's land-based, it's a much more powerful transmitter, and it's broadcasting on a longer wavelength, and that makes it pretty much impossible to jam. And it's very easy to build systems that will receive GPS from satellites as well as LORAN. So if GPS is jammed, it simply switches to the alternative.
But that would require building many terrestrial LORAN installations, right?
The system is already there. It was built in the 50s and was used for many years by aviation and maritime. But unfortunately, in the US, this system is now being dismantled. I believe there was a fairly small saving involved, about $30 million. And there's a lot of experts in the field who say it would make a lot of sense to get that back up and running before something disastrous happens.
Tell me what disastrous could happen.
We had a small taste of it in San Diego in 2007 when a Navy exercise accidentally jammed GPS in the area. Not only were navigation systems lost in the harbor and the airport, but also a lot of cell phones went out of action, cash machines stopped working, the paging system at one of the hospitals used for summoning doctors stopped working. And those are only the ones we know about.
If LORAN has been so dismantled as to make it impracticable to set it back up, where does that leave us?
It can be set back up if someone wants to spend some money on it. The cost of setting it up again would be a fraction of the cost of one GPS satellite, and there's a total of 31 of them in orbit at the moment. So just for a very small extra expenditure, it could make sure that that kind of catastrophe could be avoided.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Hambling writes for New Scientist magazine.
The story of the backstory of the so-called Stuxnet computer virus reads like the plot of a high-tech espionage thriller. Last year, somebody, somewhere, possibly a government, possibly several governments, unleashed one of the most sophisticated pieces of malware ever created, specially designed, apparently, to target Iran's uranium enrichment program. In a gripping TikTok in the April issue of Vanity Fair, author Michael Joseph Gross follows the trail of Stuxnet from June 2010, when it was discovered, until the present day. And although much remains unknown, or rather unconfirmed, about the virus, one thing, says Gross, is certain. It marks a turning point, the Hiroshima of cyber warfare, and there's no going back. Michael, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
So, Act One, and let's assume this is a scenario, starts with Sergei Ulasin, who is the antivirus expert in Belarus.
Last June, Sergei was sitting in his office, and he got a report of unusual behavior on a client's computer in Iran. This person's computer just kept booting over and over and over again. He realized that this worm was exploiting a flaw in Windows that had never been seen. It was like a Trojan horse. It used USB keys to go into a computer and drop two things. The first was called a rootkit, which is essentially a way that a worm has of saying, I'm in charge here. Root means you're God, one hacker told me. The other was an injector for a payload of malicious code that would then do something, but Ulasin couldn't tell what.
Okay, so the next scene. Somebody discovers that the worm is invading little gray plastic boxes called programmable logic controllers, or PLCs. This is really scary.
PLCs make everything happen in industrial society. They open and close all the valves that make our sewage system work. They control the factories that make our cookies that we eat for lunch. They control the turning of the traffic lights from red to yellow to green. So if you found a way to make these things go haywire, you'd set civilization on its ear. There was a moment last summer when Western governments all thought that Stuxnet might be a general attack on PLCs. And it took them a while to figure out that, in fact, Stuxnet was just going for a particular kind of PLC.
And now let's cut to crazed genius Ralph Langer. He makes the Israel connection, right?
That's right. Ralph Langer is an industrial controls systems security specialist in Hamburg. He's a pilot. He is a dandy. He loves his ostrich shoes and his Dolce & Gabbana suits. Langer, as soon as he heard about Stuxnet, started reverse engineering the virus. At the same time, though, he was drawn to speculation about who made it. He focused in on two words that were in lines of the code. One was myrtus, the other guava. These are botanical terms, one of which Ralph tied via some ingenious Googling to the Book of Esther, which is a book about a Persian plot to destroy Israel, which is then foiled by the Jews. And he started Googling again. He found out that Bushehr nuclear reactor was having some technical difficulties.
Bushehr nuclear reactor in Iran.
That's right. And he put two and two together and he got five.
So now let's cut to the polar opposite kind of character from Langer, a guy named Frank Rieger. He's the one who put two and two together and got four.
That's right. A few hundred miles away in Berlin, Frank Rieger, the spokesman for the Chaos Computer Club, was also looking really closely at this. Rieger walked into the room when I first met him wearing a dark jumpsuit that was caked with ice because he had ridden his great big tricycle into work that morning and it was snowing. So Rieger, at the same time Langner was pushing his Bushehr theory, said no, in fact, Stuxnet was going after Natanz uranium enrichment facility, which is really at the core of their weapons development program.
So what did you learn that hadn't been reported before about Stuxnet after you did this pretty detailed investigation?
I think the main thing is that the story we've been telling about how Stuxnet came into the world has Israel as the main character and the United States as best supporting actor. In fact, there's more evidence to suggest it may have been the other way around. Stuxnet is not only the boldest piece of malware yet publicly known, it is also in some ways the most cautious. For instance, Stuxnet can spread via USB key, but for each USB key that Stuxnet infects, it can only hop to three machines. Now, that's enough to create a moderate chain reaction, but not a full-blown epidemic. That is a level of caution that is much more suggestive of a diplomatically minded power than not.
Has any government agency weighed in on Stuxnet?
I got a no comment from the CIA. I got odd elliptical answers that meant nothing from both U.S. Cyber Command and the NSA. And then one day in my email showed up a note from the Idaho National Laboratory. Now, INL and Siemens, the German company that made the controllers that Stuxnet was after, collaborated on a study of the vulnerabilities of those controllers a couple years ago. Some have pointed to that as possible evidence that the U.S. then used the results of that study to create Stuxnet. INL took it upon themselves to send me a statement that denied categorically any involvement in the creation of Stuxnet.
How well did Stuxnet work? Do we know?
By putting together the information we have from the International Atomic Energy Association and other sources, some physicists have been able to show with near certainty that about 1,000 of the 9,000 or so centrifuges at Natanz were
taken offline at some point.
That's right.
But also returned to line after a while.
That's right. I mean, the truth is that if Stuxnet set them back by some measure, they have certainly recovered and they are moving on. So we need to do a cost-benefit analysis of this. Was it really worth it to set them back just a little bit for just a little while if we were at the same time changing the nature of war forever?
Stuxnet is the Hiroshima of cyber war, you wrote. That is its true significance, and all the speculation about its target and its source should not blind us to that larger reality. We have crossed a threshold, and there is no turning back.
The essence of cyber war is that you can never know for sure who shot the gun. You can never know for sure who dropped the bomb. There's no way to look up in the sky and see the marks on the bottom of the plane. There's no way ever to be sure who to blame. We have no international treaties governing the use of cyber weapons. The Chinese and the Russians have both articulated explicitly their policies on what cyber warfare will look like, but the United States has yet to do that. So we're still in kind of a Wild West situation here. And whoever let Stuxnet loose into the wild before the terms of this conversation have been defined has done something really quite reckless.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Joseph Gross is an author and journalist whose article, A Declaration of Cyber War, appears in the April issue of Vanity Fair.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, with more help from Andrew Parsons, Carlin Gallietti, and Andy Lancet. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and she had help this week from Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.